Recording taking place in Falls Church, Virginia on Sunday, January 9th, 1966, between Edward B. Garvey of the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club and Mr. George T. Corbin. I am Mr. Garvey, the other voice is that of Mr. Corbin. The Potomac Appalachian Trail Club maintains about 250 miles of hiking trails in the Blue Ridge Mountains and surrounding areas and maintains 13 locked cabins. One of these cabins is called Corbin Cabin, and that is the subject of our conversation today. In 1953, the Trail Club obtained permission from the Shenandoah National Park to renovate an abandoned mountaineer's cabin in the park. This is about 7 miles north of the intersection of U.S. Highway 211 and Skyline Drive. The renovation project took approximately a year. The Corbins, when they left there, had just built a new metal roof on the cabin prior to the time they were evicted in 1938, and the roof was still in good condition. At the dedication ceremonies in 1954, George Corbin, then living in Ida, Virginia, was invited to attend and did attend. An article concerning the building of the cabin originally was written in the July-September 1954 issue of the Potomac Appalachian Trail Club Bulletin. This article is by Alvin E. Peterson. Other information concerning Nicholson Howell and George Corbin is contained in the book Skyland by George Freeman Pollock, copyright 1960 by the Chesapeake Book Company, Library of Congress catalog card number 60-16567. George, I'd like to have you tell us a little bit about the building of the cabin, when you were born, and various aspects of life in Nicholson Hollow. Could you tell us now when you were born, when you built the cabin, and some of these details?
I was born August 2nd, 1888. And just the date when I built the cabin.
I think that was around 1909 or 10, according to
Peterson. Yeah, that's right. Mr. Peterson, we checked back. Well, he's got it, though, is when I built it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you were around 21 or 22 then, I believe.
That's right.
Were you married then, George, when you built the cabin?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. This was your first wife?
Second wife.
Your second wife.
Kirsten had died.
So you lived with your first wife and your father's?
All the time. She lived in with my father.
Mm-hmm.
Madison Corbin.
Madison Corbin, that was your father's name.
Yeah.
Now, your father owned about 50 acres of land there, did he?
Yeah.
And then when you built your cabin, you acquired some of that?
Yeah, I bought 4 or 5 acres that I built on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Could you tell me about building the cabin itself, George? What you went through, what help you got, and so forth?
Well, I had to go to the mountain and cut all these logs and haul them out with a horse. Then I hewed them myself.
And these weren't sawn, these were all hewn?
All hewn by hand.
What kind of a tool did you use to do that?
Broad axe.
Broad axe.
If they couldn't do that, I used my regular chopping axe.
Mm-hmm.
Stretch a line,
mm-hmm.
hew to that line, make a line with a chalk, you know,
yeah.
And hew them down. Then when I got them all ready, well, then we had what we call a house raising.
Mm-hmm.
Gang come in, taking 4 column in and 4 or 4 to keep the logs up to us. Mm-hmm. To build it, and then we called it rivet off, put these ribs on for the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And till night before night come, we had it ready for the roof. Well, I'd stood then, and I had to do all the rest by hand, this mm-hmm. long as I could do it, outside of working at other jobs to make a living.
Yeah.
See, I was living with my father.
Mm-hmm. While you were building the cabin.
That's right.
How many men did you have helping you build the cabin that day?
Just about 10. About 10 of us, yeah.
Their wives come too, and children, or to the house raising?
Well, I had none, but...
I mean, did the men bring their wives and families?
Oh, no.
Just the men themselves?
We fed them at my father's house.
I see.
We all had lunch there. We called it dinner then.
Yeah. Then, after the house was raised, what about the shingles and all the rest of it?
Well, I went to the mountain and cut these trees and rivet out by hand, what you call a froe.
Mm-hmm.
Rib them out, covered it. That stayed on so many years and got bad. And then I went and borrowed this money, Mr. Judd, and went to Culpeper and bought the metal roof and put it on, hard money. cousin, he was a carpenter and a tenor too.
Mm-hmm.
And the same, I bought that in Culpeper and all the ceiling that's in it.
Mm-hmm.
Hauled it up to Culpeper on a truck, and from there I hauled it up on a wagon.
Mm-hmm.
And the roof's still on there now.
That's right, I've seen that roof. It's still a good roof.
Yeah, good roof, yeah.
See, that roof's been up there almost 30 years now.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good roof. Now, you moved in there, I guess, around 1910, George. This was your second wife, was it?
Yeah, second wife. I didn't live in with the first, and I lived with my father all the time. She didn't live but about 2 years after we married.
Mm-hmm. Now, your first wife, she was a Nicholson, was she?
Corbin.
She was a Corbett.
Yeah.
She was a Corbett. And she's married, you told me, I believe, in Hannah Run, is that
right? Yeah, lived up Hannah Run.
Now, how many of your children were born in the cabin that we have now?
That we're speaking of?
Yeah.
All four of them.
Four of your children.
The preacher and Virgil and the daughter that's in Michigan and the boy that died here.
I might say that George's youngest son, Franklin, was his
Franklin,
name.
Yeah.
We're recording this at 315 South Virginia Avenue in Falls Church, and Franklin died here just about 3 years ago of a heart attack. This was George's youngest son who was working here with him in Falls Church.
Served in the army too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now your wife died, your second wife died in the cabin, didn't she, George?
No, she removed. Yeah, the second wife died
yeah.
in it, that's
yeah.
right. The first and in my father's house.
Now how old was it? She died in childbirth, didn't she?
Yeah, my second wife.
And
yeah.
how old was the baby when she...
About 3 hours old.
3 hours. Yeah. This was in the wintertime, too, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, and we did a winter. Dr. Long, he rode to the foot of the mountain in a car, and I had a horse over there and rode across the Blue Ridge full ice and come down and waited on her, and I went back with him, and after we left, she died.
She died real suddenly, then?
Yeah.
Then you had a three-hour-old baby. Who took care of the baby, then?
Just first one, then the other. My sister-in-law kept it a long time, and then a doctor, his wife, took it, and they had trouble, and then I just had it churned out till I married my last wife, Franklin's mother, and she took it and raised all four of the children. They was all small.
I see.
And she died in the university hospital. We sent her back from Ida.
Oh, I see.
And my last wife.
That's when you're living at Ida.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, the cemetery you have, I've seen there, George, across from the cabin. How many people are buried in the cemetery, would you say?
Well, there's 25 or 30.
25. They're mostly Nicholsons, were they?
Mostly, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, yeah, right. Just about all of them. There was Uncle Rust and his wife and my father and old man Aaron Nichols, he was buried at Wolftown, but mm-hmm. his wife was buried there. So he was married the second time.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people buried there.
I see.
Preacher Nicholson, and a lot of them buried there.
Well, I notice you've got a good fencer on it and a good iron gate.
Yeah,
I've
got that fence at Luray and hauled it up that mountain and put it in and everything.
Could you tell me a little bit about the funerals in those times, George, what it cost, what they did, the ceremony and so forth?
Funeral didn't cost much. We had the casket, we call them coffins then, get a nice one for $20.
Those are made down
at
where?
Down at Nether's Mills.
Oh,
a man named Rob Jones, find a carpenter and make as pretty a casket as you ever seen.
Mm-hmm. They make them to order, or would he have them in stock?
No, he'd make them by hand.
To order, as soon as the person died, you mean?
Yeah, made them all alike then until he got to getting these northern ones.
What do you mean by northern ones?
Well, that's the ones like to use now.
Oh, just the box type?
Yeah,
uh-huh.
That's right. But the ones he made, law, it was... I liked them a whole lot better.
They were made to fit the person who had just died.
Yeah,
I
made
see.
In the shape of the person. Come out here and run down there at the foot.
Mm-hmm.
The head is bulls here at the shoulder.
Yeah.
Pretty things.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and there's real timber in them.
Were they made out of chestnut or oak?
Well, he made them out of the finest oak, lots of times out of black walnut.
I see. Those cost $20.
Yeah.
And there was no embalming of them?
No embalming, whatever.
And you dug your own grave and so forth?
Everything. The neighbors would dig them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Tell me, George, that quite a bit of money there was made out of what they call this tan bark industry. Could you tell me about that?
Oh, yeah. That tan bark project run before they ever got the oil out of 8 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Peeing it and getting it out of the mountains, hauling it clear to Luray.
That's where they, was there a, what do they have at Luray where they use
they
the
tan? They got a tannery, it's steel doll, where
I see.
Buy this old bark and haul it down, grind it, and put it in vats, you know, and then had the juice out of this bark, why, it would tan these hides, you know, make genuine leather.
Yeah.
Now, they can't get it. The leather's tan too quick. Leather don't last like it used to.
Well, now, who owned all this land where the tan bark work was going on?
Why, Mr. Pollock.
I see.
But they got out about all of it before he come in and showed them what they did of. He wasn't bothered about it. He never gave them no trouble. Well, he knowed he couldn't.
Uh-huh.
My grandfather claimed it at one time. And
mm-hmm.
But after find out, well, he did sell some of it. He gave Mr. Woodard and John Woodard and Pete Sowers authority to peel it.
Mm-hmm.
He did know it. But
what was this process where you took off the tan bark? How'd you go about it? Would you explain that?
Well, you'd take it off with spuds when the sap was running, chop the tree down, then let it lay till it turned yaller, and stack it up, and then they'd come through and make roads to it, and we'd do these wagons and haul it to Leroy, to the tan yard.
Now these were, what kind of trees mostly for the using tan bark work?
Chestnut oak.
Chestnut oak?
Chestnut oak.
How about chestnut itself?
No, that's no good.
Oh, it had to be one of the oak?
We did use spruce pine a while. They didn't pay much accord for that, and that didn't work as good as the chestnut oak.
Chestnut oak was the best?
The best, yeah, far better.
And after you cut the trees and took the bark off, what happened to the...
They just laid down, went to nothing, rotted up.
Didn't use them for anything else?
No,
at all?
Indeed. Nothing to use them for.
Not even for firewood?
No sawmills in there. No, most of them was too far back up against the mine. We had firewood close to us, all around us.
Yeah. That's a shame, just to cut all that nice timber just for the bark and then throw it away or let it rot. George, you used to make a little money, according to Pollock's book. You made some very good peach brandy and some apple brandy, and I guess... during a period there, you did a little moonshining too, could you?
Yeah, I moonshined for 5 years. I made peach brandy, apple brandy, and regular whiskey. That's made out of rye and corn.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Where did you have your still for the whiskey?
Had it back in the mountain.
Right near your house there?
Well, at one time did, but they got the hunting for me so much, I put it further back in the mountain.
Is this the one you built up, this hemp patch run, you call it?
Yeah, I had one up yonder, and they never did get that still. The still they got, I had it down in Nichols Hollow piece, making this apple brandy.
I see.
But they got that and told the people when they went down, Mr. Nevis, see, did you catch anybody? See, no, it was reported to us, a cripple man owned it, but see, if he's a cripple man, I'd hate to see one run that wasn't crippled.
That was you that was a crippled man, huh?
No, they reported the cripple man, I'd sent him to Leroy, if he'd have been bothered, they'd have got him.
Yeah.
I sent him to Leroy to get more charred kegs to put this brand in. We'd made 15 gallons the night before and had run enough to make 8 or 10 more runs at that, but destroyed it all.
How did they hear about it? Did someone in
somebody poked us.
Yeah.
Yeah, down at Nevis.
Yeah. Now on the making whiskey, about how many gallons and how long would it take to make a batch of that stuff?
Well, it took, if it was warm weather, it took 72 hours after set the mash to work off, then 3 days and nights to run it. Very slow. Had a 50-gallon copper steel.
Mm-hmm.
You make it good, you got to run it slow.
Mm-hmm.
And not let the water be hot, that's get hot in the cooling tub.
Mm-hmm.
Run it fast, what makes it so hot and fiery.
Yeah.
That's right.
Now you had to be there all the time?
All the time, three of us. One would go out and get something to eat or come back and bring the others something.
Did the revenuers ever find you when you're making your whiskey up there?
No, they never did.
How come?
Only close to me that time when I was making the apple brandy.
How come you quit making moonshine?
Well, I just knew if I kept it up, I'd be caught, and if they caught you then, you got a year in Atlanta, Georgia, and that's the reason I run so when they was right on me.
That's a mighty good reason.
Yeah, I quit myself. I knew if I did keep it up, I'd be caught, then I'd get no credit, and I just quit it myself.
George,
I made it and hauled it into Washington City, right here through Falls Church in a Model T car.
Is that right?
That's right.
I never did catch you.
Never did.
I see. George, you grew a lot of your own food there. And you mentioned, I think one time, that you had sauerkraut and things like that. What were some of the things that you grew there for your own
use? Well, we grew all of our corn and lots of times wheat, and the buckwheat, and grow our own vegetables, beans, and cabbage, and everything you need to dig in the way of vegetables. We have to all put away in the cellar for winter. You know, it's the root cellar.
The root cellar outside your place there, yeah.
We all have them. My father had a big one.
Yeah.
And them that didn't have them, they'd buried it. Of course, these are better. You couldn't put things up. We'd pull up cabbage, hundreds of heads, dig a trench, pull it up with the roots, and set the head down in it, throw the dirt back, and put in another row. You go any time in the winter and take them cabbage out, they're just as good as the day you put them in though.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the taters, you couldn't let them freeze.
Yeah.
Freezing helps cabbage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Same way turnips, where there was a lot of turnips. You had to bury them, keep them from freezing.
You bury them right down the ground.
Turnips, yeah, that's right.
Uh-huh.
And the taters, too, until we got cellars.
Yeah.
We buried them in 25 and 30 bushels of potatoes.
Now, did you make sauerkraut up there?
Oh, yeah, made 50 gallons at a time.
But you have a great big...
50-gallon oak barrel.
Oh, oak barrel,
yeah.
Not crockery, oak barrel.
Oak, solid oak, like you put whiskey in.
Yeah.
A lot of barrels you put it in and ruin it. It'd be soft. You get a soft wooden barrel, the sauerkraut's no count.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What kind of grain did you grow up there?
Well, we raised our corn, then we raised wheat and rye and buckwheat. That's all we raised.
Tell me about this buckwheat. Growing that, you mentioned to me that one time, too.
Oh, we sowed the buckwheat in the, about August. Hit something grows fast.
Mm-hmm.
And then you cut it in the fall after the frost takes the leaf off. And it's ripe. It turns perfectly black.
Mm-hmm.
And that's easy at first. You can get that out in a hurry.
Mm-hmm. Who ground your buckwheat for you?
Same mill down at Nevis.
And how much would they charge for grinding the...
A gallon to the bushel, which
that'd
is...
That'd be about 1/8.
Yeah.
About 12.
Well, of course, buckwheat don't weigh as much as corn. Corn weighs 56. They'd take a gallon of that, and I reckon they'd take the buckwheat in the post, and that ain't as heavy as corn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, wheat either. Wheat weighs 60 to the bushel, and corn 56.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how did you harvest your wheat and rye and so forth?
With hooks and cradles.
A hook, that's just a sickle, you mean?
That's sickle in your hand. You just reach with the left and get a bunch and cut it off, throw it down, get a whole lot down, you tie that up in bundles and shock it till it dried out. Then when you had this scything cradles come, ain't everybody could use them. My uncle could use them good. I learned to use them.
A cradle, you mean?
A cradle, scything cradle.
Yeah.
You give them a swing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they would cut it and they'd stack it for you at the same time.
Yeah.
Bundle it. Yeah.
So, most of them would get these full and they'd grab it and throw it in a pile. Others would windrow, just let it come off itself. And they'd come along with a rake and rake it up and tie it in bundles.
I see.
Yeah.
Now,
a big field, two or three cradles in a day.
Well, how did you actually thresh the grain out of the stem when you...
By hand.
By hand.
Yeah. Make what we call a thrashing yard, dig down, level it off, and beat it down just as hard to the clay as could be. Then go to the mountain, cut these hickory poles, and the thrashing part out, leave about 3 or 4 feet, and beat it. Make a twist of it, and then you thrash it out with them.
Mm-hmm.
Just
mm-hmm.
throw them up over you, bring the hammer wrap, if you hear the grain of fly.
Mm-hmm. Then you'd collect the grain and take it down to the others for grinding, would you?
Yeah, clean it, and then take it down by.
Mm-hmm.
They'd grind it for you.
So then you had your corn flour and you had your wheat flour and you could make
all
bread and stuff?
Yeah, all of it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. How about these buckwheat, George? Did you make buckwheat pancakes?
That's what we used it for, buckwheat pancakes.
What did you use for syrup?
This homemade sorghum. We call it homemade molasses. Grow our sugar cane.
Mm-hmm. Did you grow some of that or your father?
My father growed it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he got the grove.
Did you have your own squeezer for making the...
No, the man would come through and bring come up and make it for so much. He had his own. You had to set this machine up and had a grip and sweep to it and hook a horse to it.
Yeah.
And he'd just keep going around and around like you grind apples. And you man now poking this cane in and the tub here just to bring in every drop of the juice out and if the stalks would burn the next day.
Mm-hmm.
Get all the juice out and then go to making molasses soon and get a gallon or two.
Oh, you made your own molasses, but some other fellow did all the grinding for you.
Well, any of us could do that because
yeah.
he set the mill up.
Yeah, but he brought the machinery in for
he,
you.
He made
yeah.
the molasses, yeah.
And he charged you what, so much molasses or so much money?
So much molasses, or if
yeah.
you want to pay money, it didn't cost much.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. It was all cheap then.
Now, About the roads and your transportation, George. Did you have roads anywhere near you there?
Oh, the road was the county run hit up. Well, they finally made it public to the top of the Blue Ridge.
From down in Nethers, you mean?
Yeah.
All the way up?
Yeah, that's a county road.
I see.
Come right up there by the cabin and went on and surveyed it to the top of the mountain. That's the reason I know how far it was from the cabin to the top. It's 2 miles.
Now, could you drive on those roads by car?
Not with car, no. Just horse and wagon.
Horse and wagon.
Yeah.
Did any cars ever get up very close to the cabin?
No, close as ever got was 2 miles, and then later on the county worked the road tolerable good, and my sister, she drove a Model T right in the yard where the cabin's at now from York, Pennsylvania. A brand new 5-passenger Model T. He had the curtains, you know.
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah.
Now, did many cars get up there by up to your cabin, or was she
going? That was the first and last.
First and last car,
yeah.
A Model T Ford.
Model T.
I see. Mighty good.
Close I'd get mine is 2 miles. I had a garage because I don't know. Well, of course, they just worked the road. How she got up there and back?
She probably wouldn't want to try it again. That must have been a pretty rough ride.
Yeah, it was.
I see. Did you own a car later, didn't you, yourself? You had a Model T.
Yeah, I had a Model T then parked down the hall of 2 miles.
Uh-huh. But you never tried to drive yours all the way up?
Never in life, no. Dr. Ross, a good driver. He never would bring it no further than the church, and we'd, he,
uh-huh.
If nobody's out of the horse, he'd walk the 2 mile and come on to see us.
Where was the church, George?
Right at the forks of Hannah's Run and Nichols Holler.
I see, where the Hughes River and the Hannah Run come together there.
Yeah.
And that was about 2 miles from you, or 2.5?
Just about 2.5 miles up to my house from where the church is at.
How often did you have services at the church there?
Well, when they first built it, he hardly ever run only once a month.
Well, once a month you would have?
First Sunday.
The first Sunday of every month. Where was the preacher from?
Well, Preacher Brown, he's from Spurville, Virginia, over in Rappahannock. He'd come but to this schoolhouse, but my brother, he was a minister, he built this church, and he preached pretty regular then.
I see.
Then he had the one built at Beach Spring in Rappahannock County,
mm-hmm.
Brother Warren.
Mm-hmm. I see. Now, you had a school somewhere near you, didn't you, George?
In 2 miles at the schoolhouse.
That was down the river also?
Yeah, just after you cross the river, after you leave the cabin, go down 2 miles, he'd sit back up there. You wouldn't notice it, well, I don't reckon I could find it now.
Yeah. Well, now, how long was a school open each year?
4 months.
From what month? What months of the year?
I forget, it opened in the fall, and they taught 4 months.
Just 4 months each year?
4 months each year.
Now, that's where you went to school, isn't it, George?
That's where I went to school.
And
2 miles every morning to walk down. It was all downhill, and 2 miles to walk back.
Yeah. And how many years did you go to school there?
I wouldn't say how many. I just can't remember it, but anyhow, I stopped when I got into 8th grade.
When you're in the 8th grade, you stopped. That'd be your make you around 13 or 14 years of age,
that's
I guess.
Right.
Let's see. Where was your nearest store, George, where you did your trading?
Nethers, Virginia. That was 5 miles from the cabin.
Now, you'd take a wagon down there, would you?
Oh, yeah, we'd haul on the wagons. We had horses. And Father, he had a wagon, 2 horses. He hauled Bob Clare to Louisville with his team. Of course, have to make 2 and 3 trips up to the top of the mountain to have a load to go to Louisville.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't pull much up there at once.
Mm-hmm.
Take 2 good horses, pull a half a cord up there.
Up to Luray, you mean?
Yeah, up
the
mountain.
Over the top of the mountain,
yeah. They could take on 2 horses, take a cord, and then you had to lock heavy to get down that mountain.
Mm-hmm.
Most time we cut a pretty long young tree, you know, tied to the hind part of the wagon. That keep them pushing the horses so.
Oh, going downhill.
Going down on the other side. That was steep.
Oh, I see.
Very steep from the side from the cabin up.
I see.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Now, did you have any community affairs there? Any get-togethers in the neighborhood when the whole group would get together?
Oh, yeah. They'd get together and help one another with the crops, you know, to harvest them. And
That was a community affair.
Community affair, help one another.
Now, did the wives come to those things too, or just the husband?
Oh, then the community place, like shucking the corn. Lots of the neighborhood women had come.
And then they had one big cookout, I suppose, at the end of the day.
They all would eat at one place and drink the liquor and have a big time up until all the corn is shucked out, all My father, one year ago, he had 40 barrels in the pile. Mm. And every time you'd get a red year, the rule was then call for a drink. Mm. Bottle had to go around.
Call for what?
A drink of brandy. Ought to have plenty of brandy at these shows.
What was the expression, a red year?
Yeah, red year, call for a drink.
And what do you mean by red year?
Blood red, lot of red corn.
Oh, when the corn got red, yeah. Those years when they had...
Yeah, you can plant corn and plant all together white, and once in a while you'll find a red year.
Uh-huh.
And then they'd holler another drink.
Yeah. Well, now,
and if they didn't find it, they drink right along.
Oh, I see. That was just a good excuse.
Yeah, that's right. That's just silly.
Now, Aaron Nicholson was your grandfather.
Yeah, he's my grandfather on the mother's side.
And where was his house?
His was down below the cabin on the left of the river, short piece.
Oh, that's that big one with
the stone chimney.
On both ends.
Chimney in, and then the stone built up on each side of the whole size of the end of the house.
Well, didn't your grandfather own most of that valley?
He claimed it, but he didn't own it.
Well, he didn't actually own it, then.
No, he actually owned when Mr. Pollock came in and showed him how much they did own. Well, he only had a genuine deed for 5 acres.
5 acres?
5 acres.
Well, didn't he tell a group of people that he owned the whole valley?
Owned it. These men come in by horseback, well-dressed men. See, Uncle Mr. Nichols, he called. See, could you give us any idea how much land you own in here? Well, you see, you start right there at the pinnacle, and as far as your eyes and let you see, he turned clear around and took all the Blue Ridge in.
That'd be about 5,000 acres, wouldn't it?
Yeah, Mr. Pollock owned 5,371 that he took in. That's and then on the other side, a man in New York owned the other side, all except what deed land that I was in. That's called Christidor land.
Yeah.
That's really deed land. And he claimed it all and wound up he had nothing but five acres.
All he had time
house set on, a little orchard.
How much did your dad own there?
He owned 50 acres.
Mm-hmm.
And he bought that off of, I forget who he bought off of.
Mm-hmm.
But that was on the altogether another track of land.
Mm-hmm.
This on the left of the river going down, that was Mr. Pollock's track. 5,371 acres, he was run to the Rappahannock line.
Mm-hmm.
Clear on the skyland.
Well, George, you put a new metal roof on that cabin of yours shortly before you left. That was in 1938, I think, that you and your family left there. How come that you left the cabin?
Well, the park, it took over and said we'd have to move out, and they'd build us homes out in the valley, and we could move into them and give them to us. And wound up, we had them to buy, and them that wasn't able to buy, sent the law by and set them out in the road, just like dogs or hogs.
Pretty rough treatment, huh?
Well,
now, how much money did you get for your 5 acres and your home right there in the...
They allowed me $500 for it, and I didn't get a nickel of that. I borrowed $500 to Mr. Lee Judd across the mountain to repair the house, and he wouldn't charge me no interest. See, they've robbed you of everything got, and I give him the $500.
So you got the house all renovated, new roof and so forth, borrowed $500.
Yeah, to do that,
and then
repair it, and seal it, and get all this stuff from Culpeper and everything.
Then you were evicted, and they gave you $500, and that just paid for the roof.
Yeah, that's all they lied me for, and I went on and gave it to Mr. Judd.
Yeah, pretty rough. George, you mentioned one time, and I read it in Pollock's book about Charlie Sisk, the outlaw. And you mentioned that he killed
Jack Dodson and Goldie Cabin, where I live 2 miles below.
But that was down near the school then?
Yeah, down close, just beyond where the church was at, down below Hannah's Run.
They got in an argument? Had they been drinking or something, or what?
No, just Dodson, he followed him up, and Charlie, he'd come up in the holler to hire a horse for him and his wife to come to Leroy to try the Algers. They'd kill the Gray. And Jack Dodson got with him, he was drinking, and clenched him and got a rock. Charlie was trying to get over these drug bars, we call them, where you lay down to go through and put them back up. And Charlie, he just pulled out this .32. I sold him the gun, well, before it ever happened, and shot him dead.
His widow's still alive, is she down there in Nethers?
I don't know whether Charlie's widows are living a lot. See, he was married.
No, I mean the Dodson widow.
Oh, yeah, she's living.
Yeah.
It was her husband he killed.
Yeah.
And Dotson, he was a, his mother was Jimmy Nevels' sister, and he was a well-to-do man. They went and employed lawyers and everything. Charlie says he's got 35 years in the penitentiary for it.
Yeah.
Then he broke out twice, and they added on to that. Well, then Governor Byrd, he was governor a whole term in Richmond. And the Rappahannock people, like Charlie says, so them big rich fellas, Fletcher and Millers and all of them, they got up a petition, and Governor Byrd, before he give up, he pardoned him.
Oh, I see. So
yeah, Governor Byrd pardoned him.
I see.
Yeah, he never got out. He hadn't a day.
Because
he never got a fire trial. Charlie was no man mean like people count him to be.
Yeah.
I lived by him, close to him, worked for him, and anything. Well, he's a cowardly man. And, of course, a coward, they'll shoot you quicker than somebody else if they think they're gonna, you're going to hurt them. But Charlie says you get along with him even when he's drinking.
Mm-hmm.
Charlie wasn't due all that term he got
shooting
him.
Yeah. Well, George, do you think that as you look back on it now, the mountain families were all evicted from there? They've gone down into the valleys. They've gotten a little better educations, I think. Aren't they living better now? Aren't your children living a little better than you lived back then?
Oh, yes. They wouldn't, none of them would. Very few of them would go back if I wouldn't, if it was given to them.
So as it turned out,
so inconvenient.
Yeah. As it turned out, it's probably better, wasn't it?
Better for them, that's right.
A little better life. I know
Virgil's. It would have just to treat them right to got them out and not have taken what they had for nothing.
Yeah. I know Virgil has a nice home there in Luray and so forth.
Yes, that's right.
Well, George,
I told you too about my oldest son of being an ordained minister. He lives in Madison. Virgil, he's a graduate of D.L. Moody's Bible Institute.
Mm-hmm. And your little daughter's in Michigan now.
And my daughter's in Michigan, Charlotte, Michigan.
Well, George, we're almost out of tape here. It's been real good talking to you, and this is a story of George Corbin and the cabin he built in Nicholson Hollow in the Shenandoah National Park.
I'm so glad you visited me and got the information.
Thank you, George.
Thank you.
Now,
I don't know if you'll mess up again.
Again, it better not.